Chapter 24. I returned to the vicarage to find Hawes waiting for me in my study. He was pacing up and down nervously, and when I entered the room, he started as though he had been shot.
"You must excuse me," he said, wiping his forehead. "My nerves are all to pieces lately."
"My dear fellow," I said, "you positively must get away for a change. We shall have you breaking down altogether, and that will never do."
"I can't desert my post. No, that is the thing I will never do."
"It's not a case of desertion. You are ill. I'm sure Haydock would agree with me."
"Haydock, Haydock, what kind of a doctor is he? An ignorant country practitioner."
"I think you're unfair to him. He has always been considered a very able man in his profession."
"Oh, perhaps. Yes, I dare say, but I don't like him. However, that's not what I came to say. I came to ask you if you would be kind enough to preach tonight instead of me. I really do not feel equal to it."
"Why, certainly, I will take the service for you."
"No, no, I wish to take the service. I am perfectly fit. It is only the idea of getting up in the pulpit, of all those eyes staring at me."
He shut his eyes and swallowed convulsively. "It is clear to me that there is something very wrong indeed the matter with Hawes." He seemed aware of my thoughts, for he opened his eyes and said quickly,
"There is nothing really wrong with me. It's just these headaches, these awful racking headaches. I wonder if you could let me have a glass of water."
"Certainly," I said. I went and fetched it myself from the tap. Ringing bells is a profitless form of exercise in our house. I brought the water to him and he thanked me. He took from his pocket a small cardboard box and, opening it, extracted a rice paper capsule which he swallowed with the aid of the water.
"A headache powder," he explained.
I suddenly wondered whether Hawes might have become addicted to drugs. It would explain a great many of his peculiarities.
"You don't take too many, I hope," I said. "No. Oh, no. Dr. Haydock warned me against that. But it is really wonderful. They bring instant relief."
Indeed, he already seemed calmer and more composed. He stood up.
"Then you will preach tonight. It's very good of you, sir."
"Not at all. And I insist on taking the service, too. Get along home and rest."
"No.
I won't have any argument. Not another word." He thanked me again. Then he said, his eyes sliding past me to the window,
"You have been up at Old Hall today, haven't you, sir?"
"Yes."
"Excuse me, but were you sent for?"
I looked at him in surprise, and he flushed.
"I'm sorry, sir, I just thought some new development might have arisen, and that was why Mrs. Prothero had sent for you."
I had not the faintest intention of satisfying Hawes' curiosity. She wanted to discuss the funeral arrangements and one or two other small matters with me, I said.
"Oh, that was all. I see."
I did not speak. He fidgeted from foot to foot and finally said,
"Mr. Redding came to see me last night. I can't imagine why."
"Didn't he tell you?"
He just said he'd thought he'd look me up. Said it was a bit lonely in the evenings. He's never done such a thing before."
"Well, he's supposed to be pleasant company," I said, smiling.
"What does he want to come and see me for? I don't like it."
His voice rose shrilly.
"He spoke of dropping in again. What does it all mean? What idea do you think he has got into his head?"
"Why should you suppose he has any ulterior motive?" I asked.
"I don't like it," repeated Hawes obstinately. "I've never gone against him in any way. I never suggested that he was guilty, even when he accused himself. I said it seemed most incomprehensible. If I'd had suspicions of anybody, it's been of Archer, never of him. Archer is a totally different proposition. A godless, irreligious ruffian, a drunken blackguard."
Don't you think you're being a little harsh? I said. After all, we really know very little about the man.
A poacher, in and out of prison, capable of anything.
Do you really think he shot Colonel Protheroe? I asked curiously. Hawes has an inveterate dislike of answering yes or no. I have noticed it several times lately.
Don't you think yourself, sir, that it's the only possible solution?
As far as we know, I said, there's no evidence of any kind against him.
His threats, said Hawes eagerly. You forget about his threats.
I am sick and tired of hearing about Archer's threats. As far as I can make out, there is no direct evidence that he ever made any.
He was determined to be revenged on Colonel Protheroe. He primed himself with drink and then shot him.
That's pure supposition.
But you will admit that it's perfectly probable.
No, I don't.
Possible, then?
Possible, yes. Hawes glanced at me sideways.
Why don't you think it's probable?
Because, I said, a man like Archer wouldn't think of shooting a man with a pistol. It's the wrong weapon. Hawes seemed taken aback by my argument. Evidently, it wasn't the objection he had expected.
Do you really think the objection is feasible?
He asked doubtingly. To my mind, it is a complete stumbling block to Archer's having committed the crime, I said. In face of my positive assertion, Hawes said no more. He thanked me again and left. I had gone as far as the front door with him, and on the hall table I saw four notes. They had certain characteristics in common. The handwriting was almost unmistakably feminine. They all bore the words, by hand, urgent. And the only difference I could see was that one was noticeably dirtier than the rest. Their similarity gave me a curious feeling of seeing not double, but quadruple. Mary came out of the kitchen and caught me staring at them.
Come by Anne since lunchtime, she volunteered. All but one. I found that in the box.
I nodded, gathered them up, and took them into the study. The first one ran thus. Dear Mr. Clement, something has come to my knowledge which I feel you ought to know. It concerns the death of poor Colonel Protheroe. I should much appreciate your advice on the matter, whether to go to the police or not. Since my dear husband's death, I have such a shrinking from every kind of publicity. Perhaps you could run in and see me for a few minutes this afternoon. Yours sincerely, Martha Price Ridley. I opened the second. Dear Mr. Clement, I am so troubled, so excited in my mind to know what I ought to do. Something has come to my ears that I feel may be important. I have such a horror of being mixed up with the police in any way. I am so disturbed and distressed. Would it be asking too much of you, dear vicar, to drop in for a few minutes and solve my doubts and perplexities for me in the wonderful way you always do? Forgive my troubling you. Yours very sincerely, Caroline Weatherby. The third, I felt, I could almost have recited beforehand. Dear Mr. Clement, something most important has come to my ears. I feel you should be the first to know about it. Will you call in and see me this afternoon sometime? I will wait in for you. This militant epistle was signed Amanda Hartnell. I opened the fourth missive. It has been my good fortune to be troubled with very few anonymous letters. An anonymous letter is, I think, the meanest and cruelest weapon there is. This one was no exception. It purported to be written by an illiterate person, but several things inclined me to disbelieve that assumption. Dear Vicar, I think you ought to know what is going on. Your lady has been seen coming out of Mr. Redding's cottage in a surreptitious manner. You know what I mean. The two are carrying on together. I think you ought to know. A friend. I made a faint exclamation of disgust, and crumpling up the paper, tossed it into the open grate, just as Griselda entered the room. "What's that you're throwing down so contemptuously?" she asked. "Filth," I said. Taking a match from my pocket, I struck it and bent down. Griselda, however, was too quick for me. She had stooped down and caught up the crumpled ball of paper and smoothed it out before I could stop her. She read it, gave a little exclamation of disgust, and tossed it back to me, turning away as she did so. I lighted it and watched it burn. Griselda had moved away. She was standing by the window looking out into the garden. "Len," she said, without turning round. "Yes, my dear." "I'd like to tell you something. Yes, don't stop me. I want to, please. When Lawrence Redding came here, I let you think that I had only known him slightly before. That wasn't true. I had known him rather well. In fact, before I met you, I had been rather in love with him. I think most people are with Lawrence. I was, well, absolutely silly about him at one time. I don't mean I wrote him compromising letters or anything idiotic like they do in books, but I was rather keen on him once." "Why didn't you tell me?" I asked. "Oh, because I don't know exactly, except that, well, you're foolish in some ways. Just because you're so much older than I am, you think that I'm likely to like other people. I thought you'd be tiresome, perhaps, about me and Lawrence being friends." "You're very clever at concealing things," I said, remembering what she'd told me in that room less than a week ago, and the ingenious way she had talked. "Yes, I've always been able to hide things. In a way, I like doing it." Her voice held a childlike ring of pleasure to it. "But it's quite true what I said. I didn't know about Anne, and I wondered why Lawrence was so different. Not noticing me. I'm not used to it." There was a pause. "You do understand, Len," said Griselda anxiously. "Yes," I said, "I understand." But did I? Chapter 25. I found it hard to shake off the impression left by the anonymous letter. Pitch soils. However, I gathered up the other three letters, glanced at my watch, and started out. I wondered very much what this might be that had come to the knowledge of three ladies simultaneously. I took it to be the same piece of news. In this, I was to realize that my psychology was at fault. I cannot pretend that my calls took me past the police station. My feet gravitated there of their own accord. I was anxious to know whether Inspector Slack had returned from Old Hall. I found that he had, and further, that Miss Cram had returned with him. The fair Gladys was seated in the police station, carrying off matters with a high hand. She denied absolutely having taken the suitcase to the woods.
"Just because one of these gossiping old cats had nothing better to do than look out of her window all night, you go and pitch upon me. She's been mistaken once, remember, when she said she saw me at the end of the lane on the afternoon of the murder. And if she was mistaken then, in daylight, how can she possibly have recognised me by moonlight? Wicked it is, the way these old ladies go on down here. Say anything they will, and me asleep in my bed as innocent as can be. You ought to be ashamed of yourselves, the lot of you."
"And supposing the landlady of the Blue Boar identifies the suitcase as yours, Miss Cram?"
"If she says anything of the kind, she's wrong. There's no name on it. Nearly everybody's got a suitcase like that. As for poor Dr. Stone, accusing him of being a common burglar,
and he has a lot of letters after his name.
You refuse to give us any explanation then, Miss Cram?
No refusing about it. You've made a mistake, that's all. You and your meddlesome marples. I won't say a word more, not without my solicitor present. I'm going this minute, unless you're going to arrest me.
For answer, the inspector rose and opened the door for her, and with a toss of the head, Miss Cram walked out.
That's the line she takes, said Slack, coming back to his chair. Absolute denial. And, of course, the old lady may have been mistaken. No jury would believe you could recognise anyone from that distance on a moonlit night. And, of course, as I say, the old lady may have made a mistake.
She may, I said, but I don't think she did. Miss Marple is usually right. That's what makes her unpopular. The inspector grinned.
That's what Hurst says. Lord, these villagers.
What about the silver, Inspector?
Seemed to be perfectly in order. Of course, that meant one lot or the other must be a fake. There's a very good man in Much Benham, an authority on old silver. I've phoned over to him and sent a car to fetch him. We'll soon know which is which. Either the burglary was an accomplished fact, or else it was only planned. Doesn't make a frightful lot of difference either way. I mean, as far as we're concerned. Robbery's a small business compared with murder. These two aren't concerned with the murder. We'll maybe get a line on him through the girl. That's why I let her go without any more fuss.
I wondered, I said.
A pity about Mr. Redding. It's not often you find a man who goes out of his way to oblige you.
I suppose not, I said, smiling slightly.
Women cause a lot of trouble,
moralised the inspector. He sighed and then went on, somewhat to my surprise.
Of course, there's Archer.
Oh, I said. You've thought of him?
Why, naturally, sir, first thing. It didn't need any anonymous letters to put me on his track.
Anonymous letters, I said sharply. Did you get one, then?
That's nothing new, sir. We get a dozen a day, at least. Oh, yes. We were put wise to Archer, as though the police couldn't look out for themselves. Archer's been under suspicion from the first. The trouble of it is, he's got an alibi. Not that it amounts to anything, but it's awkward to get over.
What do you mean by it's not amounting to anything? I asked.
Well, it appears he was with a couple of pals all the afternoon. Not, as I say, that that counts much. Men like Archer and his pals would swear to anything. There's no believing a word they say. We know that, but the public doesn't. And the jury's taken from the public, more's the pity. They know nothing, and 10 to 1 believe everything that's said in the witness box, no matter who it is that says it. And of course Archer himself will swear till he's black in the face that he didn't do it.
Not so obliging as Mr. Redding, I said with a smile.
Not he,
said the inspector, making the remark as a plain statement of fact. It is natural, I suppose, to cling to life, I mused.
You'd be surprised if you knew the murderers that have got off through the soft-heartedness of the jury, said the inspector gloomily.
But do you really think that Archer did it? I asked. It has struck me as curious all along that Inspector Slack never seems to have any personal views of his own on the murder. The easiness or difficulty of getting a conviction are the only points that seem to appeal to him.
I'd like to be a bit surer, he admitted. A fingerprint now, or a footprint, or seen in the vicinity about the time of the crime. Can't risk arresting him without something of that kind. He's been seen round Mr. Redding's house once or twice, but he'd say that was to speak to his mother. A decent body she is. No, on the whole, I'm for the lady. If I could only get definite proof of blackmail. But you can't get definite proof of anything in this crime. It's theory, theory, theory. It's a sad pity that there's not a single spinster lady living along your road, Mr. Clement. I bet she'd have seen something if there had been."
His words reminded me of my cause, and I took leave of him. It was about the solitary instance when I had seen him in a genial mood. My first call was on Miss Hartnell. She must have been watching me from the window, for before I had time to ring, she had opened the front door and, clasping my hand firmly in hers, had led me over the threshold.
"So good of you to come. In here. More private."
We entered a microscopic room about the size of a hen coop. Miss Hartnell shut the door and, with an air of deep secrecy, waved me to a seat. There were only three. I perceived that she was enjoying herself.
"I'm never one to beat about the bush," she said in her jolly voice,
the latter slightly toned down to meet the requirements of the situation.
"You know how things go the rounds in a village like this."
"Unfortunately," I said, "I do."
"I agree with you. Nobody dislikes gossip more than I do. But there it is. I thought it my duty to tell the police inspector that I'd called on Mrs. Lestrange the afternoon of the murder and that she was out. I don't expect to be thanked for doing my duty. I just do it. Ingratitude is what you meet with first and last in this life. Why, only yesterday, that impudent Mrs. Baker."
"Yes, yes," I said, hoping to avert the usual tirade. "Very sad, very sad. But you were saying?"
"The lower classes don't know who are their best friends," said Miss Hartnell. "I always say a word in season when I'm visiting. Not that I'm ever thanked for it."
"You were telling the inspector about your call upon Mrs. Lestrange," I prompted.
"Exactly. And by the way, he didn't thank me. Said he'd ask for information when he wanted it. Not those words exactly, but that was the spirit. There's a different class of men in the police force nowadays."
"Very probably," I said. "But you were going on to say something."
"I decided that this time I wouldn't go near any wretched inspector. After all, a clergyman is a gentleman. At least, some are," she added.
I gathered that the qualification was intended to include me.
"If I can help you in any way," I began. "It's a matter of duty," said Miss Hartnell, and closed her mouth with a snap. "I don't want to have to say these things. No one likes it less. But duty is duty."
I waited.
"I've been given to understand," went on Miss Hartnell,
turning rather red,
"that Mrs. Lestrange gives out that she was at home all the time, that she didn't answer the door because, well, she didn't choose. Such airs and graces. I only called as a matter of duty, and to be treated like that."
"She has been ill," I said mildly.
"Ill? Fiddlesticks! You're too unworldly, Mr. Clement. There's nothing the matter with that woman. Too ill to attend the inquest, indeed. Medical certificate from Dr. Haydock? She can wind him round her little finger. Everyone knows that. Well, where was I?"
I didn't quite know. It is difficult with Miss Hartnell to know where narrative ends and vituperation begins.
"Oh, about calling on her that afternoon. Well, it's fiddlesticks to say she was in the house. She wasn't. I know."
"How can you possibly know?" Miss Hartnell's face turned redder. In someone less truculent, her demeanour might have been called embarrassed.
"I'd knocked and rung," she explained, "twice, if not three times, and it occurred to me suddenly that the bell might be out of order."
She was, I was glad to note, unable to look me in the face when saying this. The same builder builds all our houses, and the bells he installs are clearly audible when standing on the mat outside the front door. Both Miss Hartnell and I knew this perfectly well, but I suppose decencies have to be preserved.
"Yes," I murmured. "I didn't want to push my card through the letterbox. That would seem so rude, and whatever I am never rude."
She made this amazing statement without a tremor.
so I thought I would just go round the house and tap on the window pane," she continued unblushingly. "I went all round the house and looked in at all the windows, but there was no one in the house at all."
I understood her perfectly. Taking advantage of the fact that the house was empty, Miss Hartnell had given unbridled rein to her curiosity and had gone round the house examining the garden and peering in at all the windows to see as much as she could of the interior. She had chosen to tell her story to me, believing that I should be a more sympathetic and lenient audience than the police. The clergy are supposed to give the benefit of the doubt to their parishioners. I made no comment on the situation. I merely asked a question. "What time was this, Miss Hartnell?"
"As far as I can remember," said Miss Hartnell, "it must have been close on 6 o'clock. I went straight home afterwards and got in about 6:10, and Mrs. Prothero came in somewhere round about the half hour, leaving Dr. Stone and Mr. Redding outside, and we talked about bulbs, and all the time the poor Colonel lying murdered. It's a sad world."
"It is sometimes a rather unpleasant one," I said. I rose. "And that is all you have to tell me?"
"I just thought it might be important."
"It might," I agreed. And refusing to be drawn further, much to Miss Hartnell's disappointment, I took my leave. Miss Weatherby, whom I visited next, received me in a kind of flutter.
"Dear Vicar, how truly kind. You've had tea. Really, you won't? A cushion for your back? It is so kind of you to come round so promptly. Always willing to put yourself out for others."
There was a good deal of this before we came to the point, and even then it was approached with a good deal of circumlocution.
"You must understand that I heard this on the best authority."
In St. Mary Mead, the best authority is always somebody else's servant. "You can't tell me who told you."
"I promised, dear Mr. Clement, and I always think a promise should be a sacred thing."
She looked very solemn.
"Shall we say a little bird told me? That is safe, isn't it?"
I longed to say it's damned silly. I rather wish I had. I should have liked to observe the effect on Miss Weatherby.
"Well, this little bird told that she saw a certain lady who shall be nameless."
"Another kind of bird?" I inquired. To my great surprise, Miss Weatherby went off into paroxysms of laughter and tapped me playfully on the arm, saying,
"Oh, Vicar, you must not be so naughty."
When she had recovered, she went on.
"A certain lady. And where do you think this certain lady was going? She turned into the vicarage road, but before she did so, she looked up and down the road in a most peculiar way, to see if anyone she knew were noticing her, I imagine."
"And the little bird?" I inquired.
"Paying a visit to the fishmongers, in the room over the shop."
I know where maids go on their days out. I know there is one place they never go if they can help, anywhere in the open air.
"And the time," continued Miss Weatherby, leaning forward mysteriously, "was just before 6 o'clock.
"On which day?" Miss Weatherby gave a little scream.
"The day of the murder, of course, didn't I say so?"
"I inferred it," I replied. "And the name of the lady?"
"Begins with an L,"
said Weatherby, nodding her head several times. Feeling that I'd got to the end of the information Miss Weatherby had to impart, I rose to my feet.
"You won't let the police cross-question me, will you?"
said Miss Weatherby pathetically, as she clasped my hand in both of hers. "I do shrink from publicity, and to stand up in court." "In special cases," I said, "they let witnesses sit down." And I escaped. There was still Mrs. Price Ridley to see. That lady put me in my place at once.
"I will not be mixed up in any police court business," she said grimly, after shaking my hand coldly. "You understand that. On the other hand, Having come across a circumstance which needs explaining, I think it should be brought to the notice of the authorities.
Does it concern Mrs. Lestrange? I asked.
Why should it?
Demanded Mrs. Price Ridley coldly. She had me at a disadvantage there.
It's a very simple matter, she continued. My maid Clara was standing at the front gate. She went down there for a minute or two. She says to get a breath of fresh air. Most unlikely, I should say. Much more probable that she was looking out for the fishmonger's boy. If he calls himself a boy. Impudent young jackanapes. Thinks because he's 17 he can joke with all the girls. Anyway, as I say, she was standing at the gate and she heard a sneeze.
Yes, I said, waiting for more.
That's all. I tell you, she heard a sneeze. Don't start telling me I'm not so young as I once was and may have made a mistake, because it was Clara who heard it, and she's only 19.
But, I said, why shouldn't she have heard a sneeze? Mrs. Price Ridley looked at me in obvious pity for my poorness of intellect.
She heard a sneeze on the day of the murder at a time when there was no one in your house. Doubtless the murderer was concealed in the bushes, waiting his opportunity. What you have to look for is a man with a cold in his head.
Or a sufferer from hay fever, I suggested. But as a matter of fact, Mrs. Price Ridley, I think that mystery has a very easy solution. Our maid, Mary, has been suffering from a severe cold in the head. In fact, her sniffing has tried us very much lately. It must have been her sneeze your maid heard.
It was a man's sneeze, said Mrs. Price Ridley firmly, and you couldn't hear your maid sneeze in your kitchen from our gate.
You couldn't hear anyone sneezing in the study from your gate, I said. Or at least, I very much doubt it.
I said the man might have been concealed in the shrubbery, said Mrs. Price Ridley. Doubtless, when Clara had gone in, he effected an entrance by the front door.
Well, of course, that's possible, I said. I tried not to make my voice consciously soothing, but I must have failed, for Mrs. Price Ridley glared at me suddenly.
I am accustomed not to be listened to, but I might mention also that to leave a tennis racket carelessly flung down on the grass without a press completely ruins it. And tennis rackets are very expensive nowadays.
There did not seem to be rhyme or reason in this flank attack. It bewildered me utterly.
But perhaps you don't agree, said Mrs. Price Ridley.
Oh, I do, certainly.
I am glad. Well, that is all I have to say. I wash my hands of the whole affair.
She leaned back and closed her eyes, like one weary of this world. I thanked her and said goodbye. On the doorstep, I ventured to ask Clara about her mistress's statement.
It's quite true, sir. I heard a sneeze, and it wasn't an ordinary sneeze, not by any means.
Nothing about a crime is ever ordinary. The shot was not an ordinary kind of shot. The sneeze was not a usual kind of sneeze. It was, I presume, a special murderer's sneeze. I asked the girl what time this had been, but she was very vague. Some time between 6:15, she thought. Anyway,
it was before the mistress had the telephone call and was took bad.
I asked her if she had heard a shot of any kind, and she said the shots had been something awful. After that, I placed very little credence in her statements. I was just turning in at my own gate when I decided to pay a friend a visit. Glancing at my watch, I saw that I had just time for it before taking evensong. I went down the road to Haydock's house. He came out on the doorstep to meet me. I noticed afresh how worried and haggard he looked. This business seemed to have aged him out of all knowledge.
I'm glad to see you, he said. What's the news?
I told him the latest stone development.
A high-class thief, he commented. Well, that explains a lot of things. He'd read up his subject, but he made slips from time to time to me. Protheroe must have caught him out once. You remember the row they had? What do you think about the girl? Is she in it too?
Opinion as to that is undecided, I said. For my own part, I think the girl is all right.
She's such a prize idiot, I added. Oh, I wouldn't say that. She's rather shrewd, is Miss Gladys Cram. A remarkably healthy specimen, not likely to trouble members of my profession.
I told him that I was worried about Hawes, and that I was anxious that he should get away for a real rest and change. Something evasive came into his manner when I said this. His answer did not ring quite true.
Yes, he said slowly. I suppose that would be the best thing. Poor chap. Poor chap.
I thought you didn't like him.
I don't. Not much. But I'm sorry for a lot of people I don't like.
He added, after a minute or two,
I'm even sorry for Protheroe.
Poor fellow.
Nobody ever liked him much. Too full of his own rectitude and too self-assertive. It's an unlovable mixture. He was always the same, even as a young man.
I didn't know you knew him then.
Oh, yes. When we lived in Westmoreland, I had a practice not far away. That's a long time ago now. Nearly 20 years.
I sighed. 20 years ago, Griselda was 5 years old. Time is an odd thing.
Is that all you came to say to me, Clement?
I looked up with a start. Haydock was watching me with keen eyes.
There's something else, isn't there? He said.
I nodded. I had been uncertain whether to speak or not when I came in, but now I decided to do so. I like Haydock as well as any man I know. He's a splendid fellow in every way. I felt that what I had to tell might be useful to him. I recited my interviews with Miss Hartnell and Miss Weatherby. He was silent for a long time after I'd spoken.
It's quite true, Clement, he said at last. I've been trying to shield Mrs. Lestrange from any inconvenience that I could. As a matter of fact, she's an old friend. But that's not my only reason. That medical certificate of mine isn't the put-up job you all think it was.
He paused and then said gravely,
This is between you and me, Clement. Mrs. Lestrange is doomed.
What?
She's a dying woman. I give her a month at longest. Do you wonder that I want to keep her from being badgered and questioned?
He went on.
When she turned into this road that evening, it was here she came, to this house.
You haven't said so before.
I didn't want to create talk. 6 to 7 isn't my time for seeing patients, and everyone knows that. But you can take my word for it that she was here.
She wasn't here when I came for you, though. I mean, when we discovered the body.
No. He seemed perturbed. She'd left to keep an appointment.
In what direction was the appointment? In her own house?
I don't know, Clement. On my honour, I don't know.
I believed him, but...
And supposing an innocent man is hanged, I said. No, he said. No one will be hanged for the murder of Colonel Protheroe. You can take my word for that.
But that is just what I could not do. And yet the certainty in his voice was very great.
No one will be hanged, he repeated.
This man, Archer, he made an impatient movement.
Hasn't got brains enough to wipe his fingerprints off the pistol.
Perhaps not, I said dubiously. Then I remembered something, and taking the little brownish crystal I had found in the wood from my pocket, I held it out to him and asked him what it was. He hesitated. Looks like picric acid. Where did you find it? That, I replied, is Sherlock Holmes' secret. He smiled. What is picric acid?
Well, it's an explosive.
Yes, I know that, but it's got another use, hasn't it? He nodded.
It's used medically, in solution for burns. Wonderful stuff.
I held out my hand, and rather reluctantly he handed it back to me. It's of no consequence, probably, I said. But I found it in rather an unusual place.
You won't tell me where?
Rather childishly, I wouldn't. He had his secrets, well, I would have mine. I was a little hurt that he had not confided in me more fully.
Chapter 26. I was in a strange mood when I mounted the pulpit that night. The church was unusually full. I cannot believe that it was the prospect of Hawes preaching which had attracted so many. Hawes' sermons are dull and dogmatic, and if the news had got round that I was preaching instead, that would not have attracted them either, for my sermons are dull and scholarly. Neither, I am afraid, can I attribute it to devotion. Everybody had come, I concluded, to see who else was there, and possibly exchange a little gossip in the church porch afterwards. Haydock was in church, which is unusual, and also Lawrence Redding. And to my surprise, beside Lawrence, I saw the white, strained face of Hawes. Anne Protheroe was there, but she usually attends Evensong on Sundays, though I had hardly thought she would today. I was far more surprised to see Lettice. Church-going was compulsory on Sunday morning. Colonel Protheroe was adamant on that point, but I had never seen Lettice at evening service before. Gladys Cram was there, looking rather blatantly young and healthy against a background of wizened spinsters, and I fancied that a dim figure at the end of the church who had slipped in late was Mrs. Lestrange. I need hardly say that Mrs. Price Ridley, Miss Hartnell, Miss Weatherby, and Miss Marple were there in full force. All the village people were there, with hardly a single exception. I don't know when we have had such a crowded congregation. Crowds are queer things. There was a magnetic atmosphere that night, and the first person to feel its influence was myself. As a rule, I prepare my sermons beforehand. I am careful and conscientious over them, but no one is better aware than myself of their deficiencies. Tonight, I was of necessity preaching extempore, and as I looked down on the sea of upturned faces, a sudden madness entered my brain. I ceased to be in any sense a minister of God. I became an actor. I had an audience before me, and I wanted to move that audience, and more, I felt the power to move it. I am not proud of what I did that night. I am an utter disbeliever in the emotional revivalist spirit. Yet that night, I acted the part of a raving, ranting evangelist. I gave out my text slowly. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. I repeated it twice, and I heard my own voice, a resonant, ringing voice, unlike the voice of the everyday Leonard Clement. I saw Griselda from her front pew look up in surprise, and Dennis follow her example. I held my breath for a moment or two, and then I let myself rip. The congregation in that church were in a state of pent-up emotion, ripe to be played upon. I played upon them. I exhorted sinners to repentance. I lashed myself into a kind of emotional frenzy. Again and again, I threw out a denouncing hand and reiterated the phrase, "I am speaking to you!" And each time, from different parts of the church, a kind of sighing gasp went up. Mass emotion is a strange and terrible thing. I finished up with those beautiful and poignant words, perhaps the most poignant words in the whole Bible. "This night thy soul
shall be required of thee.
It was a strange, brief possession. When I got back to the vicarage, I was my usual faded, indeterminate self. I found Griselda rather pale. She slipped her arm through mine. "Len," she said, "you were rather terrible tonight. I didn't like it. I've never heard you preach like that before."
"I don't suppose you ever will again," I said, sinking down wearily on the sofa. I was tired.
"What made you do it?"
A sudden madness came over me.
"Oh, it wasn't something special."
"What do you mean, something special?"
"I wondered, that was all. You're very unexpected, Len. I never feel I really know you."
We sat down to cold supper, Mary being out.
"There's a note for you in the hall," said Griselda. "Get it, will you, Dennis?"
Dennis, who had been very silent, obeyed. I took it and groaned. Across the top left-hand corner was written, "By hand, urgent." "This," I said, "must be from Miss Marple. There's no one else left." I had been perfectly correct in my assumption. "Dear Mr. Clement, I should so much like to have a little chat with you about one or two things that have occurred to me. I feel we should all try and help in elucidating this sad mystery. I will come over about 9:30, if I may, and tap on your study window. Perhaps dear Griselda would be so very kind as to run over here and cheer up my nephew. And Mr. Dennis too, of course, if he cares to come. If I do not hear, I would expect them and will come over myself at the time I have stated. Yours very sincerely, Jane Marple." I handed the note to Griselda.
"Oh, we'll go," she said cheerfully. "A glass or two of homemade liqueur is just what one needs on Sunday evening. I think it's Mary's blancmange that is so frightfully depressing. It's like something out of a mortuary."
Dennis seemed less charmed at the prospect.
"It's all very well for you," he grumbled. "You can talk all this highbrow stuff about art and books. I always feel a perfect fool sitting and listening to you."
"That's good for you," said Griselda serenely. "It puts you in your place. Anyway, I don't think Mr. Raymond West is so frightfully clever as he pretends to be."
"Very few of us are," I said.
I wondered very much what exactly it was that Miss Marple wished to talk over. Of all the ladies in my congregation, I considered her by far the shrewdest. Not only does she see and hear practically everything that goes on, but she draws amazingly neat and apposite deductions from the facts that come under her notice. If I were at any time to set out on a career of deceit, it would be of Miss Marple that I should be afraid. What Griselda called the nephew amusing party started off at 9:00, and whilst I was waiting for Miss Marple to arrive, I amused myself by drawing up a kind of schedule of the facts connected with the crime. I arranged them, so far as possible, in chronological order. I am not a punctual person, but I am a neat one, and I like things jotted down in a methodical fashion. At 9:30, punctually, there was a little tap on the window, and I rose and admitted Miss Marple. She had a very fine Shetland shawl thrown over her head and shoulders, and was looking rather old and frail. She came in, full of little fluttering remarks.
"So good of you to let me come, and so good of dear Griselda. Raymond admires her so much. The perfect Gruise, he always calls her. No, I won't have a footstool."
I deposited the Shetland shawl on a chair and returned to take a chair facing my guest. We looked at each other, and a little deprecating smile broke out on her face.
"I feel that you must be wondering why I am so interested in all this. You may possibly think it's very unwomanly. No, please, I should like to explain, if I may.
She paused a moment, a pink colour suffusing her cheeks.
"You see," she began at last, "living alone, as I do, in a rather out-of-the-way part of the world, one has to have a hobby. There is, of course, wool work and guides and welfare and sketching, but my hobby is, and always has been, human nature. So varied and so very fascinating. And, of course, in a small village with nothing to distract one, one has such ample opportunity for becoming what I might call proficient in one's study. One begins to class people quite definitely, just as though they were birds or flowers, group so-and-so, genus this, species that. Sometimes, of course, one makes mistakes, but less and less as time goes on. And then, too, one tests oneself. One takes a little problem. For instance, the guild of picked shrimps that amused dear Griselda so much. A quite unimportant mystery, but absolutely incomprehensible unless one solves it right. And then there was that matter of the changed cough drops and the butcher's wife's umbrella, the last absolutely meaningless, unless on the assumption that the greengrocer was not behaving at all nicely with the chemist's wife, which, of course, turned out to be the case. It is so fascinating, you know, to apply one's judgment and find that one is right."
"You usually are, I believe," I said, smiling.
"That, I am afraid, is what has made me a little conceited," confessed Miss Marple. "But I have always wondered whether, if some day a really big mystery came along, I should be able to do the same thing. I mean, just solve it correctly. Logically, it ought to be exactly the same thing. After all, a tiny working model of a torpedo is just the same as a real torpedo."
"You mean it's all a question of relativity?" I said slowly. "It should be, logically, I admit, but I don't know whether it really is."
"Surely it must be the same," said Miss Marple. "The, what one used to call the factors at school, are the same. There's money, and the mutual attraction people of an opposite sex. And there's queerness, of course. So many people are a little queer, aren't they? In fact, most people are, when you know them well. And normal people do such astonishing things sometimes, and abnormal people are sometimes so very sane and ordinary. In fact, the only way is to compare people with other people you have known or come across. You'd be surprised if you knew how very few distinct types there are in all."
"You frighten me," I said. "I feel I'm being put under the microscope."
"Of course, I wouldn't dream of saying any of this to Colonel Melchett. Such an autocratic man, isn't he? And poor Inspector Slack, well, he's exactly like the young lady in the boot shop who wants to sell you patent leather because she's got it in your size, and doesn't take any notice of the fact that you want brown calf."
"That really is a very good description of Slack."
"But you, Mr. Clement, know, I'm sure, quite as much about the crime as Inspector Slack. I thought, if we could work together..."
"I wonder," I said. "I think each one of us, in his secret heart, fancies himself as Sherlock Holmes." Then I told her of the three summonses I had received that afternoon. I told her of Anne's discovery of the picture with the slashed face. I also told her of Miss Cram's attitude at the police station, and I described Haydock's identification of the crystal I had picked up. "Having found that myself," I finished up, "I should like it to be important, but it's probably got nothing to do with the case."
"I have been reading a lot of American detective stories from the library lately," said Miss Marple, "hoping to find them helpful."
"Was there anything in them about picric acid?"
"I'm afraid not. I do remember reading a story once, though, in which a man was poisoned by picric acid and
and lanolin being rubbed on him as an ointment. But as nobody has been poisoned here, that doesn't seem to enter into the question, I said. Then I took up my schedule and handed it to her. I've tried, I said, to recapitulate the facts of the case as clearly as possible. My schedule. Thursday, 21st inst. 12:30 p.m. Colonel Protheroe alters his appointment from 6 to 6:15. Overheard by half village, very probably. 12:45. Pistol last seen in its proper place, but this is doubtful, as Mrs. Archer had previously said she could not remember. 5:30, approx. Colonel and Mrs. Protheroe leave Old Hall for village in car. 5:30. Fake call put through to me from the North Lodge, Old Hall. 6:15, or a minute or two earlier, Colonel Protheroe arrives at Vicarage, is shown into study by Mary. 6:20, Mrs. Protheroe comes along back lane and across garden to study window. Colonel Protheroe not visible. 6:29, call from Lawrence Redding's cottage put through to Mrs. Price Ridley, according to exchange. 6:30 to 6:35, shot heard. Accepting telephone call time as correct, Lawrence Redding, Anne Protheroe, and Dr. Stone's evidence seem to point to its being earlier, but Mrs. P.R. probably right. 6:45, Lawrence Redding arrives Vicarage and finds the body. 6:48, I meet Lawrence Redding. 6:49, body discovered by me. 6:55, Haydock examines body. Note. The only two people who have no kind of alibi for 6:30 to 6:35 are Miss Cram and Mrs. Lestrange. Miss Cram says she was at the Barrow, but no confirmation. It seems reasonable, however, to dismiss her from case as there seems nothing to connect her with it. Mrs. Lestrange left Dr. Haydock's house some time after 6 to keep an appointment. Where was the appointment, and with whom? It could hardly have been with Colonel Protheroe, as he expected to be engaged with me. It is true that Mrs. Lestrange was near the spot at the time the crime was committed, but it seems doubtful what motive she could have had for murdering him. She did not gain by his death, and the inspector's theory of blackmail I cannot accept. Mrs. Lestrange is not that kind of woman. Also, it seems unlikely that she should have got hold of Lawrence Redding's pistol.
Very clear, said Miss Marple, nodding her head in approval. Very clear indeed. Gentlemen always make such excellent memoranda.
You agree with what I've written? I asked.
Oh, yes. You have put it all beautifully.
I asked her the question then that I'd been meaning to put all along. Miss Marple, I said, who do you suspect? You once said that there were 7 people.
Quite that, I should think, said Miss Marple absently. I expect every one of us suspects someone different. In fact, one can see they do.
She didn't ask me who I suspected.
The point is, she said, that one must provide an explanation for everything. Each thing has got to be explained away satisfactorily. If you have a theory that fits every fact, well, then it must be the right one. But that's extremely difficult. If it wasn't for that note.
The note? I said, surprised.
Yes, you remember, I told you. That note has worried me all along. It's wrong, somehow.
Surely, I said, that is explained now. It was written at 6:35, and another hand, the murderer's, put the misleading 6:20 at the top. I think that is clearly established.
But even then, said Miss Marple, it's all wrong.
But why?
Listen.
Miss Marple leant forward eagerly.
Mrs. Protheroe passed my garden, as I told you, and she went as far as the study window, and she looked in, and she didn't see Colonel Protheroe.
Because he was writing at the desk, I said.
And that's what's all wrong. That was at 6:20. We agreed that he wouldn't sit down to say he couldn't wait any longer until after 6:30. So, why was he sitting at the writing table then?
I never thought of that, I said slowly.
Let us, dear Mr. Clement, just go over it again. Mrs. Protheroe comes to the window, and she thinks the room is empty. She must have thought so, because otherwise she would never have gone down to the studio to meet Mr. Redding. It wouldn't have been safe. The room must have been absolutely silent if she thought it was empty. And that leaves us three alternatives, doesn't it?
You mean?
Well, the first alternative would be that Colonel Protheroe was dead already. But I don't think that's the most likely one. To begin with, he'd only been there about 5 minutes, and she or I would have heard the shot. And secondly, the same difficulty remains about his being at the writing table. The second alternative is, of course, that he was sitting at the writing table writing a note. But in that case, it must have been a different note altogether. It can't have been to say he couldn't wait. And the third?
Yes, I said.
Well, the third is, of course, that Mrs. Protheroe was right, and that the room was actually empty.
You mean that after he had been shown in, he went out again and came back later?
Yes.
But why should he have done that?
Miss Marple spread out her hands in a little gesture of bewilderment. That would mean looking at the case from an entirely different angle, I said.
One so often has to do that about everything. Don't you think so?
I did not reply. I was going over carefully in my mind the three alternatives that Miss Marple had suggested. With a slight sigh, the old lady rose to her feet.
I must be getting back. I'm very glad to have had this little chat, though we haven't got very far, have we?
To tell you the truth, I said, as I fetched her shawl, the whole thing seems to me a bewildering maze.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I think, on the whole, one theory fits nearly everything. That is, if you admit one coincidence. And I think one coincidence is allowable. More than one, of course, is unlikely.
Do you really think that? About the theory, I mean, I asked, looking at her.
I admit that there is one flaw in my theory, one fact that I can't get over. Oh, if only that note had been something quite different.
She sighed and shook her head. She moved towards the window and absent-mindedly reached up her hand and felt the rather depressed-looking plant that stood in a stand.
You know, dear Mr. Clement, this should be watered oftener. Poor thing, it needs it badly. Your maid should water it every day. I suppose it is she who attends to it.
As much, I said, as she attends to anything.
A little raw at present?
Suggested Miss Marple.
Yes, I said, and Griselda steadily refuses to attempt to sack her. Her idea is that only a thoroughly undesirable maid will remain with us. However, Mary herself gave us notice the other day.
Indeed, I always imagined she was very fond of you both.
I haven't noticed it, I said.
But, as a matter of fact, it was Lettice Protheroe who upset her. Mary came back from the inquest in rather a temperamental state and found Lettice here and, well, they had words.
Oh, said Miss Marple.
She was just about to step through the window when she stopped suddenly, and a bewildering series of changes passed over her face.
Oh dear, she muttered to herself. I have been stupid. So that was it.
Perfectly possible all the time.
I beg your pardon.
She turned a worried face upon me.
Nothing. An idea that has just occurred to me. I must go home and think things out thoroughly. Do you know, I believe I have been extremely stupid, almost incredibly so.
I find that hard to believe,
I said gallantly. I escorted her through the window and across the lawn.
"Can you tell me what it is that has occurred to you so suddenly?" I asked.
"I would rather not, just at present. You see, there is still a possibility that I may be mistaken, but I do not think so. Here we are at my garden gate. Thank you so much. Please do not come any further."
"Is the note still a stumbling block?" I asked, as she passed through the gate and latched it behind her. She looked at me abstractedly.
"The note? Oh, of course, that wasn't the real note. I never thought it was. Good night, Mr. Clement."
She went rapidly up the path to the house, leaving me staring after her. I didn't know what to think.
Chapter 27. Griselda and Dennis had not yet returned. I realized that the most natural thing would have been for me to go up to the house with Miss Marple and fetch them home. Both she and I had been so entirely taken up with our preoccupation over the mystery that we had forgotten anybody existed in the world except ourselves. I was just standing in the hall, wondering whether I would not even now go over and join them, when the doorbell rang. I crossed over to it. I saw there was a letter in the box, and presuming that this was the cause of the ring, I took it out. As I did so, however, the bell rang again, and I shoved the letter hastily into my pocket and opened the front door. It was Colonel Melchett.
"Hello, Clement. I'm on my way home from town in the car. Thought I'd just look in and see if you could give me a drink."
"Delighted," I said. "Come into the study."
He pulled off the leather coat that he was wearing and followed me into the study. I fetched the whiskey and soda and two glasses. Melchett was standing in front of the fireplace, legs wide apart, stroking his closely cropped moustache.
"I've got one bit of news for you, Clement. Most astounding thing you've ever heard. But let that go for the minute. How are things going down here? Any more old ladies hot on the scent?"
"They're not doing so badly," I said. "One of them, at all events, thinks she's got there."
"Our friend Miss Marple, eh?"
"Our friend Miss Marple."
"Women like that always think they know everything," said Colonel Melchett.
He sipped his whiskey and soda appreciatively. "It's probably unnecessary interference on my part asking," I said, "but I suppose somebody has questioned the fish boy. I mean, if the murderer left by the front door, there's a chance the boy may have seen him."
"Slack questioned him right enough," said Melchett. "But the boy says he didn't meet anybody. Hardly likely he would. The murderer wouldn't be exactly courting observation. Lots of cover by your front gate. He would have taken a look to see if the road was clear. The boy had to call at the vicarage, at Haydock's, and at Mrs. Price Ridley's. Easy enough to dodge him."
"Yes," I said, "I suppose it would be."
"On the other hand," went on Melchett, "if by any chance that rascal Archer did the job, and young Fred Jackson saw him about the place, I doubt very much whether he'd let on. Archer is a cousin of his."
"Do you seriously suspect Archer?"
"Well, you know, old Prothero had his knife into Archer pretty badly. Lots of bad blood between them. Leniency wasn't Prothero's strong point."
"No," I said. "He was a very ruthless man."
"What I say is," said Melchett, "live and let live. Of course, the law's the law, but it never hurts to give a man the benefit of the doubt. That's what Prothero never did."
"He prided himself on it," I said. There was a pause, and then I asked, "What is this astounding bit of news you promised me?"
"Well, it is astounding. You know that unfinished letter that Prothero was writing when he was killed?"
"Yes."
"We got an expert on it, to say whether the 620 was added by a different hand. Naturally, we sent up samples of Prothero's handwriting. Do you know the verdict? That letter
was never written by Prothero at all.
You mean a forgery?
It's a forgery. The 620, they think, is written in a different hand again, but they're not sure about that. The heading is in a different ink, but the letter itself is a forgery. Prothero never wrote it.
Are they certain?
Well, they're as certain as experts ever are. You know what an expert is. Oh, but they're sure enough.
Amazing, I said. Then a memory assailed me. Why, I said, I remember at the time Mrs. Prothero said it wasn't like her husband's handwriting at all, and I took no notice.
Really?
I thought it, one of those silly remarks women will make. If there seemed one thing sure on earth, it was that Prothero had written that note. We looked at each other. It's curious, I said slowly. Miss Marple was saying this evening that that note was all wrong.
Confound the woman! She couldn't know more about it if she had committed the murder herself.
At that moment, the telephone bell rang. There is a queer kind of psychology about a telephone bell. It rang now persistently and with a kind of sinister significance. I went over and took up a receiver. This is the vicarage, I said. Who's speaking? A strange, high-pitched, hysterical voice came over the wire.
I want to confess, it said. My God, I want to confess.
Hello, I said. Hello? Look here, you've cut me off. What number was that? A languid voice said it didn't know. It added that it was sorry I had been troubled. I put down the receiver and turned to Melchett. You once said, I remarked, that you would go mad if anyone else accused themselves of the crime.
What about it?
That was someone who wanted to confess, and the exchange has cut us off. Melchett dashed over and took up a receiver.
I'll speak to them.
Do, I said. You may have some effect. I'll leave you to it. I'm going out. I've a fancy I recognize that voice.